22-31-67, Eric L. Patterson versus United Healthcare Insurance Company et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Parati for the plaintiff appellant.
Filing fees, expert, you're paying them all sorts of planned money. How can you pay the plan money when they are pursuing funds that it's illegal for them to pursue? They are wasting plan assets.
This is your A2 theory.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Do you have any cases that support that particular A2 theory?
We don't have any cases where we find a plan fiduciary suing for money that the plan doesn't provide. Because that usually doesn't happen. This is a very weird situation that almost every plan, Judge Hilich, Judge Seiler, I mean, every plan has subrogation. For some reason, when this plan was written, the lawyers who wrote it messed up.
Most plans provide that the medical insurance company can collect back what the injured did. This does not.
And what happened was when they hired Optum United just perform a, use their normal SP summary plan description paperwork, which says there's subrogation.
And you want your money back.
We also, there was fraud here. They were asked repeatedly, show us the plan document which allows subrogation. They kept providing a summary plan description. It wasn't until years later in a different lawsuit, as Judge Calabrese says, the smoking gun, they finally gave somebody the actual plan document. The plan document says.
But what is the consequence of that fraud? You don't have damages actually for the fraud.
No, we have an equity action.
What is the relief? And I guess the question for me comes down to under A3, you have an equitable claim for what I would describe probably as disgorgement for $25,000. Is that your claim?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Does the fraud matter to that? I mean, you're limited to the getting your money back, I take it, right?
I don't think the fraud matters to the relief that's sought.
If there is fraud.
I think the fraud matters to the fact that there's a clear breach of fiduciary duty. Now, the key is, here's where the interesting first impression question comes in. Judge Calabrese then said, okay, second, the rest of the money, not that it wasn't kept as a fee, the rest of the money went to the plan. Therefore, under various cases, Montanillo, for example, you must do tracing. And so you can't, since you didn't sue the plan, the reason we didn't sue the plan is because we were suing for the plan for these wasted assets. Since you didn't sue the plan, this is a legal remedy. We respectfully disagree.
Well,
we think
you sued the people that got the $25,000.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And your argument is those are the only people we needed to sue. We didn't need to sue the plan.
Yes, and because they say, no, they got the money, but it went moved on. It went to the plan. And therefore, you have to trace it. It's all tracing requirement. We say, no, there's no tracing requirement here. We say that if the court looks really...
I mean, the money probably did go back to the plan, right?
Possibly, yes.
Okay. You just say that we don't need that.
We're saying we've got to get a look at that. And the reason we're saying is... take a look at the SEC cases that we cited. All right? The SEC cases, and Amara talks about this idea, that the district court renders orders, and one of them is essentially surcharge. Okay? And the SEC cases talk about the idea, and this is specifically, I'm moving down to this paperwork. The SEC cases say that there's an alignment between ERISA remedies and the remedies under the Securities Exchange Act. And the cases say, but wait, some of the ERISA cases imply tracing. Here's why we think that there's a distinction that should be made by the court. These cases talk about the difference between somebody collecting under a contract, Montanillo. They're not suing the fiduciaries, they're suing the participant. The participant has no ERISA obligations. The participant is only liable if there's a contract that requires him or her to pay money back. That is an action in law. The fiduciaries and the individuals in the SEC cases, they are paying back money or being liable because of a federal statute. And in those cases, you can receive equitable relief without any tracing requirements. And the SEC has said that over and over and over again, the idea that it would be ridiculous to consider that you have to follow the money because that would encourage a wrongdoer to spend the money quickly, to transfer the money. So Optum has the money and they said, we don't have it anymore. We used it for our general operating expenses. You can't get ours. They breached the fiduciary duty. They're not a participant. They're not being sued under contract. They're being sued under ERISA. And therefore, ERISA should operate the same way as the SEC's Securities and Exchange Act operates under, I think it's 77C or 77G. And that's what we ask the court to do, is to hold when you're dealing with suits against fiduciaries, rather than Montanil, Great West versus Knudsen, suits against participants that you don't need to trace.
Okay. So the claim is equitable. It's not true, it's a disgorgement claim. It's a disgorgement claim, it's not a claim. It's not a traditional legal claim for money damages.
No, we are suing in equity, and that's what the SEC cases say very uniformly. That this is equity. And they say, but do we have to trace? And the SEC cases say we don't. We see no reason why ERISA should be any different.
Okay. Thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court, I'm Wesley Stockard, here for the defendants, appellees in the case. There was a lot that was presented by opposing counsel in his argument that suggested that they were just facts, and I don't think that that's really true when you examine the facts of the case and specifically the allegations in the complaint. And I think that context is really important for what the court has to consider as a part of its legal analysis, and so I want to start there.
Does the plan have a requirement that there be this recoupment?
Your Honor, the plan absolutely does. Opposing counsel has referenced a different case, actually filed by Mr. Patterson's wife, later in time, where there was a finding concerning a conflict between a summary plan description in a plan document when it came to the subrogation language. At the time Mr. Patterson was engaged in his accident and when this issue came up for subrogation recovery, that SPD didn't exist. That conflict that exists in that case is not present in any way, shape, or form. And there was a single document.
Was there a plan, or was there just an SPD?
There was just an SPD. And the plan document, the wrap plan document that was at issue in the wife's case didn't even exist yet. So there was a single SPD and plan document combined, which is allowed under ERISA, and it contained the express subrogation and reimbursement language that was relied on when the agent for the plan reached out to collect the subrogation and reimbursement money here. So it absolutely is, again, the only operative document. And that conflict that was an issue in that other case is absolutely not an issue here.
So that would be your defense on the merits, I take it, if the case were to continue?
Well, it definitely would be the defense on the merits if the case were to continue. But really, we haven't even decided that issue at the district court level that's up on appeal here about whether or not that language is in the plan or not. No, there was no ruling on it below, and it's not material to the district court's analysis.
It was presented to the court.
It was at their complaint stage. They presented it to the court as a part of their complaint allegations, but the district court didn't decide anything about that issue, and it's just not material to its analysis.
I mean, there is a state court finding, right?
There is a state court finding, not in this case, but in a separate case involving Mr. Patterson's wife.
Well, maybe non-mutual offensive collateral assault,
Your Honor,
it here exists under Ohio law, I don't know.
Well, it is a separate case and a finding about the plan in Ohio State Court, but it doesn't change anything about the fact that you don't have equitable claims in front of you here, or that the plaintiffs aren't seeking equitable relief.
Why isn't the disgorgement of the $25,000 enough? That seems equitable. Disgorgement is equitable.
Well, if you look at the facts in this case, this is $25,000 that was gotten from a tortfeasor in an accident. It was recovered by Mr. Patterson as a part of the settlement that he got from a third party. It was never a plan asset. It was never a benefit under the plan. The plan, when he repaid that amount in settlement of a lawsuit, and a settlement of a reimbursement claim on behalf of the plan. The plan didn't receive that benefit and agree to hold it in trust for him. It's not like those equitable lien cases like that were present in the Montanil and the Saraboff cases. He's complaining about representations that were made in connection with a lawsuit settlement and whether those are right or not, and whether or not this should be returned to him. It's not related to the administration of the plan in any way, and he wants his personal money back that he paid. Nothing about that.
Is that an argument that it's just not cognizable in A3?
That's an argument that, if you look at the Supreme Court.
I mean, is that a standing argument, or is that just a motion, a failure to state a claim argument? What, how you
It is a failure to state a claim argument under 502A3. If you look at the Supreme Court's holdings in the Montanil and Saraboff cases, what the Supreme Court said is to have an equitable claim under 502A3, you have to have both, one, an equitable basis for a claim, and two, equitable relief sought. When you look at what happened here, Mr. Patterson never came out of pocket for any money whatsoever. The plan paid these benefits directly to medical providers on his behalf. He then used that to get a third-party recovery, money from a third-party tortfeasor, and he got way more than that, and he didn't even pay back the full amount. It was $35,000.
Are these arguments that he has a state claim?
No.
Or that the claim doesn't have much merit to it?
They are arguments in facts. Factual pleading by the plaintiffs that show nothing about this claim is equitable in nature. It's not that traditional ERISA trust relationship or that ERISA fiduciary relationship in receipt of the funds that would show this to be equitable in
nature. This is what Judge Calabrese held?
That is what Judge Calabrese held. He said,
I know he agrees on the bottom line, but this is not.
I'm sorry.
I know he agreed with you on the bottom line, but in making his argument about the tracing argument, this is the same point.
It's a little bit different point, right? That goes to the equitable relief argument. What Montanil really said, when you look at that second prong of the case, whether or not the remedial relief that's sought is equitable in nature, it recognized that you have to proceed against specifically identifiable funds. If you want to get your something back as a part of equitable restitution or disgorgement, for example, then you need to be asking back for the actual money that was received and that was paid. And here, there are no factual allegations in this complaint that show any of the defendants receiving this $25,000.
Did you make this argument, Mr. Court?
Absolutely.
So Judge Calabrese decided on the other ground and didn't get
to. No, Judge Calabrese actually decided on that ground as well. He decided that, look, there are no factual allegations in this complaint where I can draw any inference other than the plan got this money. And without any factual allegations that, if true, would show any of the defendants having the money, you are not proceeding against specifically identifiable funds, which is what Montanil requires you to do. And so I can't hold that the remedy that you're seeking is that equitable in nature, or that there's a right to disgorgement from this particular.
I take it their response would be this is the traceability issue, and have they alleged, I guess I don't know, but does the complaint allege that at one point some of the defendants retained the money or were the beneficiaries of the recoupment or whatever it would be, and that we don't need to trace it then to the point that we allege that somebody at some point had this money and we're about to sue them?
Your Honor, what they have to offer at the pleading stage is they have to offer facts that if true, would plausibly lead to the inference that any defendant kept the money. And they haven't done that. What they have specifically alleged is that Optum reached out and pursued recovery on behalf of the plan. They have alleged that the settlement was paid to satisfy the plan's lien. They lump all the defendants together in the most conclusory fashion that you could possibly do and say all of these defendants kept some or all of the money, or all or a portion of the money. There are no facts about what any particular defendant actually kept, any fee they received, or anything that, if true, would actually show that to plausibly be the case. And in fact, you know, plaintiffs cited into paragraph 97 of their complaint, which says that defendants would retain for themselves some or all of the money recovered. But in the very next paragraph, paragraph 98, they say, where a count three defendant did not receive some or all of the money of a subrogation reimbursement recovery directly, defendants received indirect benefits for such recovery. So at one point they're saying the defendants kept some or all. In the very next paragraph they're saying maybe no defendant kept anything.
Well, they don't, maybe they don't know for certain. Is this a Iqbal Twombly question?
Absolutely.
Is it plausible?
It's not plausible.
What's not plausible? That there's $25,000, that it's not plausible that one of these entities holds the money. They've identified a specific one. They've identified a group of folks, and they think one of them has the money.
There are factual allegations that show that that money was specifically sought and recovered on behalf of the plan. So there is an inference that the plan would have recovered those money, but there are no other factual allegations out there that would show any other defendant actually doing anything other than returning that money to the plan. It's just not in their complaint.
Would it be necessary if you take money from me and then you give all of it to another party, can I sue you in equity for disgorgement of the money that you took from me, even though you gave it to another party?
Your Honor, the Sixth Circuit looked at that exact issue in the Werner case, and they said that is equitable restitution at law. It is not equitable restitution in the sense that's allowed for under ERISA. That Werner case is very on point. It is a case where there was a challenge to an agent for a benefit plan that pursued reimbursement recovery. And what the Sixth Circuit specifically said was, look, that is you asking to get something back that someone inappropriately took from you. That is restitution at law. It is not restitution.
So I guess the bottom line is that you're saying there is a traceability bar that would apply in these situations.
There is a
traceability. You must sue the party that is currently holding.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is a traceability.
So why isn't their allegation that you're holding some of the money? So you gave $24,000 to the plan and you kept $1,000 as your fee or something. Whatever. I don't know.
That's not alleged.
There is a general allegation that you hold some of the money, right?
The defendants collectively hold some or all of the money.
Okay, so hence the Iqbal problem.
Yep, and so we're taking bold allegations that lump together all defendants and have no factual specifics to show anyone getting the money, and we're comparing it with allegations where they admit it was pursued on behalf of the plan. We're doing this on behalf of the plan, and we're trying to now turn this into a massive class action proceeding.
But what if they're right on the merits? What would they do? In other words, if I was a plan beneficiary and somebody came to me in violation of the plan, I suppose, and got reimbursement for money that was paid, but wasn't entitled to that money under the plan, I haven't really been denied a benefit under the plan, I guess. So I don't know that I would have an A2 or an A1 type suit. How would I bring that? But I have been wronged, I suppose. So what would I do? How would I vindicate my rights?
Your Honor, there are many circuit court decisions which have recognized that in a situation where a participant under a benefit plan wants to address a subrogation reimbursement interest under the terms of the plan, they absolutely can file a A1B claim for denial of benefits to get a ruling as to what their rights are under the terms of that benefit.
So those cases view the subrogation issue as essentially denying you a benefit under the plan, and therefore you can bring an A1B claim.
They view it as a determination as to what the plan's equitable lien rights may be against the benefit amounts that you receive, which is very different. Real briefly, on the 502A2 claim, because that's also an issue, I just want to mention, here, what Mr. Patterson is seeking is the return of his $25,000 to him. And even on behalf of the class, which is not properly, that complaint was never accepted, he wants the money to go back to the individuals. There is nothing that he is really looking to return to the plan. And the courts have been very clear, the Supreme Court in the Mass Mutual Life versus Russell case, that you have to be pursuing relief on behalf of the plan as a whole in order to get that that type of claim under ERISA. And it's clear from the factual allegations here that that's not what's being pursued. Also, even if you set aside those issues, there's still an equal
recognize that theory. I thought if you were going to get money for individual people's accounts, there was a case on Cintas or something that where that issue came up. I thought you could do that. Maybe that was A2, though. I don't know where
Your Honor,
distinguishing between A2 and A3.
The case that I think you may be referencing is the LaRue case. In the LaRue case, what the Supreme Court actually held was that there, while if a participant could sue for recoveries on behalf of the plan, even if those recoveries included amounts in their own account, you still have to be proceeding for relief on behalf of the plan. And the Supreme Court made it very clear that it is not appropriate to be pursuing individual relief divorced from broader relief on behalf of the plan.
Okay, so that's just a question about whether A2 would even apply in this case.
That's right, Your Honor. And Judge Calabrese, I think, correctly held that that
did. Do you have any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Counselor Rubano.
I think we cleared up the idea that ERISA, specifically under Amara, doesn't just deal with benefits. It deals with any money of a plan participant, whether the money is paid as a.
Well, do you have an A1B claim? Would you have had an A1B claim here?
We do. We do. And we also have
a... Did Judge Calabrese deal with that?
He dealt with what the defense counsel correctly said is when we're dealing with these cases, we're dealing with an equitable basis as a plan and a remedy. He was focusing on the remedy aspect solely. He was still focusing on tracing. And number one, we have the right, a participant has the right to sue if money of theirs is taken when it shouldn't be for a ERISA plan.
But that makes some confusion. An A1B claim would be in law, right? You wouldn't have to worry about the law equity.
I'm not sure what that distinction would be in this case.
Well, you might get out of traceability. But I guess you don't seem to care about it.
No, I care, but I'm just saying, I apologize that I can't give you the distinction between those two sections.
Is there a difference in class claims aren't going to be viable under A1B versus they're more likely to be viable under A?
We think that they're viable under either because the defense says that there's nothing in the complaint saying that the defense, let's talk only about the $1,000 that you mentioned. There's nothing in the complaint saying that they kept the $1,000. Specifically, the complaint specifically said in paragraph 97 that they kept it. And then, yes, under Rule 8, we're allowed to plead the alternative. That's not an Iqbal issue. That's a pleading issue that you're allowed to do. We can also say, and if they later proved they didn't plead it, they didn't keep any of it, then the plan still can be sued for this. And it's at page ID 43 in the circuit court. Montanillo, again, dealt with the issue about traceability in a case against the participant because the case was being pursued under contract. Here, the case is being pursued under ERISA. And under ERISA, we ask you to read the Camargo case that we cited in our reply brief. In Camargo, the court said very clearly that to have a situation in which you were asking for relief and equity, and you could claim you can't get it because the money went away, at least under the SEC statute, that's not, quote, nonsense. It makes no sense. We're not seeing any either statutory language justification or prudential justification or any other justification why ERISA and the SEC statute should be applied differently. Both of them allow the court to grant relief in equity for any equitable remedy that could be available. The statute is almost identical. So why is there a, quote, tracing requirement under ERISA and not SEC? Well, the answer is that where you're dealing with a situation in these cases, and here's the language. It says, we're dealing with a situation that was distinguished by the courts as between the Eighth Circuit distinguished between private parties seeking disgorgement in a contract dispute, which is Montanillo, and in this case, the SEC acting on behalf of investors and in the public interest. The suit brought under ERISA is not pursuant to a contract. It's in the public interest pursuant to a federal statute. And we believe that that makes a difference in whether you have to have a tracing requirement. You can tell a private individual under a contract, sorry, the money's gone, you can't get it. That's what happened in Montanillo. That's what I think Justice Thomas said. Remember in Montanillo, what we had was, they got the money was put in the attorney's trust account, the attorney then sets a letter.
So if there's no traceability requirement, then it would be enough in your mind to allege that these defendants, and you do use the word defendants, I don't know, I mean, I know, I realize that it's a long complaint, I think there are some words for this elsewhere, but that the defendants at one point had the money, or that any defendants now have retained some of the money.
We allege both, that they received the money, the check was to Optum, and we allege that they kept some of the money. He's right. We don't know how much they kept. That's not an Iqbal issue or a Twombly issue. That's a discovery issue. We allege the feasible predicate that of money that they're not supposed to collect, they kept.
But it's your position that at equity, if I take the money and I give all of it to somebody else, the fact that I took the money puts me on the hook for an equitable disgorgement?
If you are a fiduciary in an ERISA case, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
At equity, not
yes.
At law.
At equity, not at law.
Okay.
And if you kept the money, then absolutely at equity. In other words, as I said at the beginning, one of these issues is a very simple error. I think that's very clear. The allegation they kept the money, he's saying, that's not true, that's a factual question. We're under rules.
Okay, I hear.
But the rest of the money,
questions.
Anything else? Thank you, General.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your briefing and your arguments. We will take the case under submission. And is that it?
That is it.